Support comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This exhibition features all four of the Spanish artists' major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. Now on view. More at NortonSimon.org.
Support for LAist comes from Visual Communications, presenting VC Film Fest, celebrating 40 years of Asian and Native Hawaiian Pacific Islander filmmaking, with over 200 films May 1st through 10th. Info at festival.vcmedia.org.
It's Film Week on LAist 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle with Tim Cogshell, critic for Alt Film Guide and Cinegods.com, and LAist film critic Leah Lowenstein. We're going to be talking about Alex Garland's film Civil War, that's already arriving with a great deal of early attention. In fact, we'll be talking with two of the film's stars later in the hour. We'll also hear about a new film from Woody Allen that arrives a bit under the radar, but is getting a theatrical screening here in Southern California. Let's dive right into Civil War, written and directed by Ex Machina's Alex Garland, the film starring Kirsten Dunst, Wagner Moura, Kaylee Spaney, and Stephen McKinley Henderson. It's set in the near future, and a civil war has broken out across the United States. The road trip takes four journalists from New York City to try and get to D.C. to interview the president before his government falls. Tim, what do you think of Civil War?
Yeah. It's from L.A., actually, is where they're traveling. So as a dramatic action film about journalists covering a war, this is good. I thought it was, but we'll talk about it in a moment. This is really good. This is sort of really works. Big set pieces featuring urban warfare, landscapes of a ravaged, war-torn country that deserve the IMAX treatment. I saw it in IMAX. Its framing is embedding the audience with these unembedded journalists as they trek across the country, a war-torn country, in the heat of an ongoing battle toward D.C. We are told, in no uncertain terms, that the United States government is going to fall. We hear this announcement on the radio. This is right at the top of the film. This is all trailer information. If it were just that, that would be all fine. But, you know, that's Starship Troopers, so no, it's not that. This movie posits other things. So a civil war in the United States, a second civil war. We know that the government has fired on the American people. We know that. Again, trailer information. We know that 19 states have seceded. Something called the Great Western Forces have joined with something called the Florida Alliance, and so on and so forth. All trailer information. Now, the filmmakers tell us that this fairly well-made movie, again, is apolitical. It's apolitical, that they intend to suggest no particular sides to this thing. It's just a thing that happened. And it's even constructed in such a way that it tries to sort of ameliorate this. We see the president, Nick Offerman's character, one time. He's wearing a red tie with blue stripes, or a blue tie with red stripes, whatever it is. But it's one of these little things. Now, to my mind, that's just not true. The film is political. It comes with politics. And if it doesn't come with politics, we certainly, American audience members, bring our politics to it. Just a thing. This may have something to do with the fact that Alex Garland is English or British. And while I love this notion that he has conceived, I think that doesn't allow him to understand that in a circumstance like this, there would be politics, and there would be a construction of this. The Civil War, the first Civil War, was started by the bad guys. The bad guys started that war. The first shot was fired by a Confederate soldier. Captain fired a shot at Fort Sumter. That's the way the war was shaped. Here he wants to have it both ways. We don't know what went down to get the Civil War started. But you can't set a movie in the near future of now, literally now, and have these characters doing these things, and then say, oh, but, you know, there's nothing political. That's silly. And then I have something to say about that movie, about those journalists.
Well, okay. First of all, Tim, I think the reason it felt like they were coming from Los Angeles is because it took 4 days for them to get to D.C.
Well, they had to go through Pittsburgh.
But pretty sure they are coming from New York, going through Pittsburgh, because the roads are all closed and they have to go around a really circuitous way to get to D.C. So we have Kirsten Dunst as this veteran photojournalist and her young sort of protege by accident, Kaylee Spaney, who hitches a ride with them. Stephen McKinley Henderson as this kind of old sage who rides along, and then Wagner Moura is the driver, who's the journalist who's determined to get one last interview with the president. Of course, no one's interviewed the president in months, and it's like it's a war zone around the White House, so we don't even know if they can get there or land an interview. But the film has a visceral energy, a pulsating energy. The scenes of Dunst photographing are just popping with color and light and vibrancy. And there's also, you know, a lot of violence. There's a ton of violence. This is not a film that shies from violence. To me, though, I know there's been a lot of debate about whether Garland should have addressed the underlying issues and the issues right now that we're facing as we are, you know, on the verge of a hypothetical civil war. But I don't think that's what he is interested in. I think it comes through. I think instead he's asking us to identify with the photographer, with both Dunst and Spaney, because they're the ones who are observers, who are recording the images as we are, as the ultimate observer, right? We're watching them watching their country fall apart, and perhaps we're watching our country fall apart. So I think that is the message that he's going for here. I don't think it's irresponsible of him not to take a political side or not to, you know, make this more overtly about politics. I think the film is about politics, but it's more about what we have done to ourselves, to our country, to, you know, to our lack of humanity, like how we've sort of how war dehumanizes and depersonalizes us all, and makes us, it almost makes us desensitized to violence in a way, which I think is kind of one of the messages as well. It reminded me of both some of the great movies about journalism, including Welcome to Sarajevo, Year of Living Dangerously, also Salvador I would put on that list. And then, you know, also just has this incredible sort of edginess to it that, you know, you can tell he's a talented filmmaker. He builds up his scenes very carefully. Like the scenes, he doesn't cut too much. He's very patient, and he sort of lets the energy rise within the scene. There's a real narrative kind of rising and falling. So I really appreciated that. I don't think it's a great film, but I think it has moments.
I think it's that journalism film, that film that involves this journalistic road trip. Look, this is a very constructed film. Kirsten Dunst is basically playing Marie Colvin. Mm-hmm. Marie Colvin was a wonderful journalist. She wore that patch over her left eye. She was killed in 2012, I think it was, assassinated actually while working, and had been in many, many war zones. And then we have these characters, her and Wagner, the veteran journalist.
In
the car.
And they talk about that at one point.
Well, that's the problem. They do, in fact, talk about
which
that,
which you didn't
don't
like?
They? No, because you know what? I can see. And we can pick up the audience. And look, Alex is a novelist. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the way you know when a novelist is directing a movie is he makes a character say everything
that
he's thinking. Because that's what novelists do. They can't help it. They keep doing it when they're making movies. And every thought in every character's head, these journalists, when they're on the road, is spoken aloud. Mm. This story about these veteran journalists and girl, you can't do this and all that. We have this commentary coming at us. You know, I'm watching this movie. And I can see it. And I don't need all of that being led down this road. So, you know, that sort of irritated me about the film. Is this a powerful, a moving film? Yes, it is. Man, look, this is a thing you might not get if you're not paying attention to what's going on in this film. These journalists that are on this road, just about everybody that they're with, mm-hmm. in terms of troops, as they're moving toward D.C., are on the traitorous side. All of those people are attacking the actual government of the... It would be the same as if these journalists were with Sherman, as Sherman went into Atlanta.
I wasn't even clear on which side everybody was on. I'm not
They're always moving toward the Capitol to go to D.C.
Yes,
and the people who are going to bring D.C. down are going to bring D.C. down. So they are therefore, de facto, those who want to
government. They might be paramilitary organizations that, you know. Anyway, one last thing mentioning. There's a terrific scene involving Jesse Plemons. The movie is worth seeing for that alone. It's so well constructed. It's just excellent.
We're talking about Civil War. Alex Garland, the writer-director of the film, and it is going to be featuring four stars, Kirsten Dunst, Wagner Moura, Kaylee Spaney, and Stephen McKinley Henderson. I'll be talking with two of them, Kaylee and Wagner, coming up later this hour on Film Week. Civil War is rated R. It's in wide release, including on many IMAX screens. The Old Oak is a British-French co-production that Ken Loach, the veteran British director, helms. Paul Laverty is the screenwriter. It stars Dave Turner, Eb Lamari, Claire Rogerson, and Trevor Fox. Leo, what do you think of Ken Loach's The Old Oak?
Well, Larry, The Old Oak may be Ken Loach's last film. He's talked about that possibility, and it's a lovely note to finish on if he does. Loach is such a wonderfully human, social realist filmmaker. He's made films like Land and Freedom, Bread and Roses, Sorry to Bother You. He's always been this
topsy-turvy.
I think that was Mike Lee, no?
Oh, you're right. That was Mike Lee. Another great English
yes,
director.
Yes, exactly. There's so many of them. But Loach is just a great chronicler of the working class, not unlike Mike Lee, by the way. And here we have, in this little town in Durham, England, an old pub called the Old Oak that's struggling. It has hardly any business, and it's fallen on hard times, and the town itself is kind of crippled economically, and a bunch of refugees arrive. They're Syrian refugees, and they're immediately ostracized and teased and kind of hassled by some of the locals. So the film is actually about, in some ways, about xenophobia, about what we assume we know about others. The proprietor of the bar befriends one of the Syrian refugees, Yara, and they sort of strike up a lovely friendship. He helps her to repair her camera that's been damaged by one of the local hooligans. And, you know, there's a sort of lovely understanding that comes out of this. And in Loach films, I think so often friendship, unexpected friendships, getting through hard times, finding a path forward, and in a very gentle, empathetic way that feels beautifully unfussy and is just it's like what I would imagine if neorealism kind of was today in England. It would be a Ken Loach film.
Oh well, yeah. The kitchen sink drama crew, that social realism school, him and Peter Weir and Mike and all those folks. My Name Is Joe is one.
I love that. Yeah.
Bread and Roses, which of course is set here in L.A.
Yeah, the janitor strike.
Which could have been set in 2023. Mm. This is how his films latch on to the reality of a moment and just sort of hold on to it so beautifully. This is an old mining community, and the mines have been shut down. All these lovely black and white pictures all over this pub. Half the pub has been closed because, all kinds of reasons. And there's a little antagonism because now you have all these Syrian refugees coming to his pub. And this guy, his name's Dave, that runs this pub. And he's just this lovely guy. Mm. And he just does not have an evil ounce in his heart. He's just decent and kind, and he's going to help these people. He's got that little dog. He is a classic Loachian character, if we can say something like that. And like with all Ken Loach films, reality is at the center of it. Mm. But Ken Loach is not dystopian. He's no Alex Garland.
No, he's not.
Ken feels like everything's going to be okay if we all kind of stick.
Yeah, with some caveats. Like there're going to be some bumps in the road. Yeah. We're gonna go along. I should say he's also working with Paul Laverty, who's written so many of his screenplays. Yeah. Again here.
We're talking about Ken Loach's film. He directed The Old Oak. Paul Laverty wrote it. It's unrated. It's at Lemley's Royal Theater in West Los Angeles. Woody Allen's latest film, Coup de Chance, is at Lemley's Monica Film Center in Santa Monica, and it's available on demand. Lael, the last few Allen films have gotten hardly any attention because, of course, of all the allegations made by his daughter and by his son, Ronan Farrow, against him. But this is one that is actually being shown in a couple of theaters.
That's right, Larry. And this is the first film that he's made completely in another language. This is financed by France and shot in France. And it's essentially persona non grata here in terms of financing and funding. So he had to go abroad. Now, the French have always embraced Woody Allen, as have the Europeans in general, but particularly the French. He's always been a darling of French cinema. And in this case, he's on familiar territory in that he's in an urban environment. France looks gorgeous. It's shot by Vittorio Storaro, the great cinematographer. Lou Delage is a very wealthy woman, kind of a little disenchanted in her marriage to a sort of mysterious businessman played by the great Melville Poupeau, who I think is a little miscast here. And she embarks on an affair with an old school chum who she happens to run into. So things like happenstance and relationships and longing, nostalgia, things like that all sort of play a little bit of a role here. The family and the social family of these friends and also sort of a discussion between what is essential in life and what isn't, you know. That's very much at work here. It's not as good as some of Allen's other films, but it's not bad.
I want to come back to it. We're going to take a break. We're talking with Leah Lowenstein, who, along with Tim Cogshell, is doing our reviews today. Coup de Chance is the new film from Woody Allen. He wrote and directed it. Lou Delage is the star of the film. It's at Lemley's Monica Film Center, but we'll hear a few more words about it when we come back in 1 minute. It's Film Week on LAist 89.3. Larry Mantle with critics Leah Lowenstein and Tim Cogshell. Leah's telling us about Woody Allen's new film. It's all in French with English subtitles. Allen writing and directing Coup de Chance. This is an improvement over his previous few films?
Well, the last kind of few, which were really sort of just, you know, almost didn't open practically. This one reminds me a little bit thematically of both kind of Match Point and a little bit of Crimes and Misdemeanors,
which is a great film.
That's a great one. Now, it's not as good as Crimes and Misdemeanors. That is vintage
Woody.
That's
a high bar.
That's a very high bar. And to me, that was really the sort of, what do you want to call it, the apotheosis of Woody, where he brought together some comedy, some drama, some great philosophizing, and, you know, just a terrific script and a great cast. You know, that was him at his best. This is, you know, like Woody doing Woody a little bit. In the last kind of decade or so, he's shot a few films in Europe. I mean, Match Point, Vicky Ferlina, Midnight in Paris, of course. And so he's back in Paris here. Paris is a city he knows well, and you know, not quite like New York, but he handles the locations well. He handles the relationships, the conversation. Does it feel like a Woody Allen movie? Yeah, somewhat it does. I don't think there's a great deal of sort of deep kind of, you know, psychoanalysis that goes on here, or even kind of like really reflection on the part of the characters. But it's fun, it's entertaining, it's, you know, and it's interesting to see this kind of in the scope of all of his work in terms of like what his interests are as an artist. And I think that's also important to give it consideration just as a work of art, like given, you know, everything that's gone on with his career, to note all that this is why he's shooting in French, because he can't make a film here. But, you know,
you know what Woody hasn't done, because I've seen all of them, is he has not acknowledged anything whatsoever to do or contextualized anything whatsoever to do with any of that controversy in any of those films. Mm. And I imagine he does not in this one.
No, and he's given some interviews where he says it's not relevant, it's silly, he feels that he was exonerated, you know. And I don't want to get in rehash all of that, but you know,
I mean, if you look at all those Woody Allen films, not only is he in those films, he's in those films. Mm. And now giant chunks of his life are not in his films.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, and there is a tendency, there's some moments in this film where I, as a critic, was sort of externalizing and was thinking about some quotes that sort of reminded me of some things that he had said in interviews. There's a moment in the film where a character says the heart is relentless, and he gave a very famous quote where he said the heart wants what it wants. So, you know, there you go.
Coup de Chance is the romantic drama from Woody Allen, writer, director, rated PG-13, Lemley Monica Film Center, and available on demand. The action-adventure comedy Sasquatch Sunset stars Riley Keough, Jesse Eisenberg. It's directed by David and Nathan Zellner. David Zellner wrote the screenplay. Nathan Zellner is in the film. Tim, what did you think of Sasquatch Sunset?
You know, I people have been poking at this movie. I rather enjoyed it. In 1981, there were a couple of movies, caveman movies, one called Caveman, another one called Quest for Fire.
Yeah.
A little bit later, A Clan of the Cave Bear. These movies that sort of explored this notion of these sort of proto-humans and what it might have been like. So this one imagines these Sasquatch, Yeti, in the great American North, whatever it is, you know, doing their thing, wandering around. We have four characters in this film, and it is a little bit silly and a bit of a comedy. But if you watch this whole movie, it gets really poignant. It gets tragic. And something's going on in this movie that's not evident at the beginning of the movie. You got to wait for it. And if you wait for it, it's kind of sharp, too.
Sasquatch Sunset from David and Nathan Zellner, Riley Keough, Jesse Eisenberg star. It's rated R. It's at the Alamo Drafthouse in downtown Los Angeles before going into wider release next week. The sci-fi drama Arcadian stars Nicolas Cage. It's his film of the month with Jaden Martell. Benjamin Brewer directs. Mike Nylund is the screenwriter. Leo, what did you think of Arcadian?
So this is a dystopian thriller with kind of a bit of a nod to A Quiet Place and The Last of Us kind of thing. It's the Earth has been taken over by some evil, which may be these
monsters.
Crazy large alien monsters. We don't really know for a while. And in the beginning of
can
the film,
can we still call them monsters, or do we need a euphemism?
We might. Nick Cage, in the very beginning of the film, we see him coming upon these two infants wrapped kind of in swaddling clothes, and I don't think they're his. Did you think they were his, Tim?
No, he finds them.
He finds these two babies and raises them. Cut to 15 years later, he's a man living alone with his two teenage boys, and there's a lot of, you know, they're living in the country, but they're very poor, and the resources are extremely scarce, and that they you're not allowed to stay out after dark.
After dark, the monsters
come. I got to tell you, you
see these things. You got to see this thing, right? And it's a monster, and it's a crazy monster.
Yeah, but
it's a crazy killing machine that you do not want to be eaten by, right?
Yes. True, but I found it also a little hilarious. Like, did you not?
Yeah.
It has these chattering teeth that remind you of like wind up teeth. Like, I can't stop going.
But they only come out at night, which means that all the scenes when you see the monsters are at night. This kid, Brewer, did a lot of special effects works on Everything Everywhere All at Once.
Right.
So, this is his calling card film. You know, you go out, you get yourself some money, you hire Nick Cage. Nick Cage is in the movie for a good 20 minutes.
Very
and then he's out
conveniently,
of the movie.
Nick Cage is unconscious or out of the movie.
He gets to bring
you into the theater, and then he kind of disappears.
but they get to display their, you know, his monster making chops, and he does, and it's pretty effective, I think. There's
some scary scenes
when this movie is over. But these kids don't know the movie's over, so they do two more scenes after that scene, and they could have, you know, you take the foot off the gas, kid. You did good.
We're talking about Arcadian from director Benjamin Brewer. Mike Nylund wrote the screenplay. Arcadian's rated R in wide release. The documentary Ryuichi Sakamoto Opus looks at the Japanese composer and all of the works created up through the end of his life. He died last year of cancer. And this includes his composition that was performed in late 2022. Tim, what did you think of this film?
Well, this is exquisite. This is just beautiful. Shot in black and white, mostly silhouetted, but not completely, on stage playing his grand piano, surrounded by whatever stage equipment is there. The camera moves in and out and close up and pans as he moves through these compositions, his sheet music atop the piano. He has this beautiful white hair that we know him by, tilted over his sheet music, and every now and again he stops and moves the music and starts again. It's breathtaking, particularly if you know him. I was first introduced to him in 1990 when he and his band, YMO or something like that, were on Soul Train. 1980.
Oh, wow.
And it was just this funky performance. They all had on these white shirts, and they were playing this very sort of Orientalist style music, but it was funky, and it was just bopping, and it was just this instrumental.
Yellow Magic Orchestra.
It was just fantastic. And of course, he was in Mere Christmas with Lawrence, where he actually starred. He started the movie so that he could get the rights to do the score. And of course, he did that breathtaking score.
And did, of course, The Last Emperor, The Revenant.
Oh, Black Rain.
Black Rain. Monster. I mean, so many films that he scored.
Yeah, and this is just him playing the piano until he's done. He passed in March of 2023.
So he performed this not long before his death.
Yeah, his son's the director of this. And, you know, it's lilting, it's poignant, it's moving. But every now and again, you know, he was a jazz guy. So every now and again, he cuts loose.
Neo Sora, the son of Sakamoto, is the director. Ryuichi Sakamoto Opus is the performance film. You can see it at the Egyptian Theater in Hollywood coming up on Sunday. It's also got multiple screenings at many of the Lemley theaters. It's unrated. Chicken for Linda is a French animated film. Lael, please tell us about it.
I really enjoyed this film, Chicken for Linda. It was an unexpected pleasure. It is a hand-painted, beautiful, kind of charming vision of a mother-daughter relationship set in France during a general strike. And just giving a little bit of context, the mother punishes the daughter unfairly for something. She has taken the mother's ring and the mother thinks that she's taken it to school and lost it and traded it to a friend. It turns out, spoiler alert, the cat has eaten the ring. So the mother apologizes profusely to her daughter and is very sorry and says, well, what do you want then? How can I make it up to you? And the daughter says, I just want chicken, daddy's favorite chicken. By the way, dad passed away. So there's a whole sort of needing to make up for the wrong, the unjust wrong. Of course, during a general strike, every place is closed. You can't find chicken. The butcher's closed. The farm is closed. Everything in France. And so there's a quest to get the chicken. Then there's some hijinks ensue. And a chicken does come along, but it's a live chicken. It has to be killed. There's wonderful sort of little screwball bits along the way. The animation is so beautiful. Each character is rendered in a different color, a different, you know, and so it's this sort of eye-popping palette of like purples and orange and pinks and yellows and greens. And you have a real kind of sense of walking into a painting that's alive. But it's also one that's full of surprises because, you know, so often in France, the suburbs have been depicted as these kind of angry places where there's a lot of fighting and violence and, you know, hating the bourgeois and so on and so forth. And in this case, the suburbs come together really over this whole chicken story, and when they have to sort of find the chicken who's run away, hopped away, as it were, and it's very funny, it's charming, and I really, really enjoyed Chicken for Linda.
It was the winner of the French César Award for Best Animated Film, so it comes highly acclaimed. Chicken for Linda is the French animated film. You can see it at Lemley's Royal Theatre, West LA, for those listening to us Friday. It's airing, showing there tonight, and then in select theaters starting on Monday. A remake of the 1991 film, Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead. This one, directed by Wade Alan Marcus, written by Chuck Hayward, Tara Eisen, and Neil Landau. It stars Simone Joy Jones and Nicole Richie, along with June Squibb. Tim, what do you think of this new Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead?
Well, they took that 1991 film, which was a favorite of executive producer Tyra Banks. She's the force behind this, and they drug it forward to the present day and blackified it, is the way I like to say it. Everybody's black in the movie. What do you get? You get more or less the same movie, interestingly, but with a little bit of cussing. And they handle that babysitter after she dies in a completely different way, for a good reason. So June Squibb, she was just wonderful in this movie. She's the old babysitter that they bring in to take care
She's always great.
In this house for all these little black kids. And the first thing you might say is, why the hell did you bring that old white lady in here to take care of these rambunctious little black kids? And you know what? She could handle it. June didn't have no trouble with that at all. But she is going to die. And then they handle that the way they handle that in this movie. I am completely and totally against the way they handle that in this movie. Although I do understand why they did what they did. Then you get the same movie. Christina Applegate's character has to go to work to take care of the family because they don't have any money because their mom has to go away on this thing. Same thing happens here. A young lady from, I think she's in that new Will Smith Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. They redid that. Mm-hmm. She's one of the leads in that. So she's great. She's great in this. And you have this movie that's literally the same movie. It's a lot of fun. It's kind of silly. Interesting. In this movie, the word that we insist on calling the N-word is used. It's used quite a lot. It's used very funnily. It's absolutely hysterical. And it's used in perfectly ordinary context in which it would occur in this black community where everybody is. I do wonder, though, that if in 1991 this movie had been made, but just with black folks, if that would have been the case. As a matter of fact, I don't wonder. I know it wouldn't have been the case. I know it wouldn't have been the case in 1991. It is the case in 2024. An interesting sort of cultural thing. I think remaking the movie with black kids, fine. I don't have any problem with that.
It's interesting, though, that very specific choice, because it was a choice.
Hmm. We're talking about Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead, remake of the 1991 film, directed by Wade Alain Marcus. It's in wide release and rated R. Leo, we have just about 40 seconds or so for the documentary on musician Judy Sill. It's titled Lost Angel, The Genius of Judy Sill.
Yeah, this is a very niche doc about a songwriter that I didn't know at all, but apparently has become, quite loved, or in any case, covers of her songs are being done by YouTube artists now over and over. She was, she had a very troubled youth and then had kind of a meteoric rise and landed on the cover of Rolling Stone magazine, which at one point claimed her one of the most important singer-songwriters of her generation. She died very young and tragically, but she certainly made a contribution. She wasn't commercial. That was her big problem. She refused to cater to the commercial whims of the industry. She also possibly greatly offended David Geffen. But there are a lot of artists who weigh in on her, David Crosby, Linda Ronstadt, Stephen Sills, and so on and so forth, and they have a lot of interesting things to say.
If you've never heard her voice is absolutely extraordinary. Mm-hmm.
We're talking about the documentary Lost Angel, The Genius of Judy Sill, directed by Andy Brown and Brian Lindstrom. You can see it at Lemley's NoHo in North Hollywood and available on demand as well. It's unrated. More to come on Film Week. I'll be talking with two of the stars of Alex Garland's Civil War when we come back in just 1 minute.
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.